administrator here, he'll have a south end, you know, some other resources on the other, just in case bad things happen, so. Any other requirements, questions, study remarks? Okay.
Yeah, Monday, we probably should put a team together and go out and inspect it.
Go for it, Harley. I'm not putting nothing else together at this point. If you want to put something together, go for it.
The nice thing about it, it's all on federal property, so even the will jurisdiction for fire, that is.
Except for this stuff, it's not on federal property.
Yeah, but I'm saying the site itself, and they're kind of funny with that.
We actually had brought in a Verizon cell on wheels, and I don't know if any of you ever sat through any of the things where they talk about these cows and how you're bringing in a disaster on a moment's notice, and it's much like, ooh. Just want 90 days notice and 10,000 sheets of paperwork before we do it, but anyway. We went to put it in here and found out they wanted to put some guy wires down to stabilize that thing. It's against federal law to put a stake in the ground here. We had to move it across the fence on the private land to set up a communications tower for us, so. That's kind of where you're going. Anyway, that's the director's report.
Okay, we had an exciting weekend, I guess, so. All right, Kimberly, report from the state.
Not a lot going on. We've got our two of our conferences coming up. I think we've talked about them before. Our emergency managers conference is on the 21st and 22nd this month. If you're not signed up, it's already too full. So, and then we have our governor's public safety summit, which is in July. This year it's in Davis County, so it's a lot closer if you're interested in going. And then also our PIO conference is coming up in September for any PIOs. If you're interested, we've got our CERC meeting. I gotta remember what the date is. I guess it didn't get put, oh, there it is. It's on June 18th, and that's the group that oversees the LEPCs, and it's always good if you ever want to come and just see what goes on, and if you have questions or just want to hear how they plan. We put out some information on hazmat guidance that we had looked for feedback from LAPCs if they wanted any changes to that before they submit that to get, what's the word I want, finalized. Anyway, that's about it. Got lots of training on our website. Want to check it out, dem.utah.gov, and it's always free.
Our paperwork is showing that's in St. George, is that not correct? Missing out the meetings of the summit.
The Governor's Safety Summit will be Davis County this year.
Yeah.
Okay, it's showing St. George, Mark.
No. It's at the Davis County Conference Center.
Oh, okay. It's called July 30th and 31st.
Yes.
As far as hazmat reports, we're working on cleanup from a few different events we had back in February. It was a busy month. We did have a call out to Milwaukee 20 on SR30 last Wednesday. We did have a semi overturn. It was miraculous. There was no major injuries, and just a little bit of motor oil and a few other engine fluids dropped, and no cleanup required. So other than that, it's been kind of quiet. I hope it stays that way, especially this weekend. The HMEP grant. Application is due June 1st. Mark, do you want to talk about that? Or Marcia?
Well, I just have to have the paperwork in by June 1st, so I don't know what you guys want to do.
They want kind of an idea of what we would want to use to expand it on. We kind of talked preliminarily, but kind of summer as we've done. Then to use some of that money for, and if we get 4,000 like we did last year, if that's still the plan, then we could potentially use to support the Preparedness Expo, which will be in September, if that's amenable to this group. We've also, and I was going to bring some in, anybody notice in your newspaper, it should have been, you know, one of the three counties, should have gotten in your newspaper, whether it's the Leader or the News Journal, that on during shakeout, we had a preparedness flyer in there that we paid for, so my intent is to use some, we'd like to use use some of the funds from their HMEP funds to pay our portion of that. Not a whole lot, $300 is on the $350 is what I'm looking at right now. If all of our sponsors step up and pay their, what they've pledged to do, you know. But like you said, there was a specific article in there about transportation and hazardous materials and stuff like that. So we'll use that to slide that underneath the fence to approve it for some of that stuff. So anyway, those are kind of some of the initial ideas we can use to expend some of that money. I'm going to step back and grab the box of shirts that we've got still, because somebody, a whole bunch of people's names on shirts. And if you're here and you didn't get a shirt ordered and built last time, we can put another order in, cover an LAPC pull shirt. So those are some of the ideas that we can use for some of that expenditure to go on.
Okay. Do you have anything from our business outreach?
I don't have any committee reports. I think, as I mentioned last time, we've been talking about utilizing this committee to maybe take on another role with business continuity, or business resiliency, business preparedness. And I think our discussion was is that those that attend this meeting probably aren't the ones from the same companies that we would like to have involved in. And that, so this is probably not going to be the best venue to crack that nut that we need to get done. I think with the county, so we're going to work with the Chamber of Commerce is probably going to be the host entity to help us to kind of build that. So talk it up with your cohorts within your companies that may be over, you know, business resiliency. And again, I realize we're probably preaching to the choir in here, because everybody hears all the bigger companies that do all that stuff and get all of your plans anyway. So what we're really going to be trying to do is reach out to those smaller businesses, even down to the mom and pop businesses, to help talk and teach them about business continuity plans, business resiliency, you know, following a disaster. I think statistically, and I don't remember specifically, but it's something to the fact that within 2 weeks or 14 days, if a business can't get back online and operating following a disaster, like there's a 70% failure rate or something. So that's huge in an economy within a county and so forth. So as this county leadership, we want to be able to help build that resiliency within the business community and the county. So anyway, we had that conversation to use that as kind of an outreach, and we're going to go a different direction on that, but that still puts us with the need to continue our outreach here, ensuring we get all the Tier 2 reporting that being done that needs to be done, but then even broader than that, try to get the business community here involved that may use even less than the reportable requirements for hazardous materials, but have hazardous materials nevertheless. So, anyway, so on the list of things to do, but not this week. We're playing trains.
Mark, just again, I'd later. Again suggest that if you're going to kick something off, to the box of the business on it, which is all time.
Yeah, and I got that note on that last one.
That you'll get the small businesses there.
Good reminder on that. Do me a favor, just keep that in front of me as well, you know, just because we're gonna move that direction. I think,
Monica
will help us with that. This is as we move along as well. Very good.
On the Tier 2 part, years ago we put together a mapping system with the Box Elder County, the GIS department. Is that still functional? Are they still putting effort into it? And I guess the next question is anybody using it? Was it a value, and is it a value to continue pushing forward on that and having those guys continue to put the effort into it?
That's a good question. Yeah, it is. Only because my goal is to work with our GIS, and we're going to be doing a lot more with GIS and building our layers of all kinds of things in the county. You know, looking at the risks and hazards and businesses. I mean, GIS is so valuable to do so many different things, and that's just one layer that are using emits a much more than we need to get going. So, yeah, Brock does stay up on that, and I probably open that up and peek at it a couple times a year, but
about the fire departments or private companies, are opening it up and looking at it from the Tier 2 report side of it, looking at the Tier 2 reports.
And I don't know about the other, but I haven't been in a while, but again, that's always when the event happens if you're going, oh crap.
Yeah.
So,
might not hurt.
Resource is valuable. We need to get actually more training in the Officer Association and have them pull it up more.
I was just thinking, might not hurt then to do another demonstration here. We've got enough new people around the table that probably don't have any idea what it is, and it might be good to demo it here again and re-push that out a little bit.
Well, I'd like to see a demo at the County Officer Association meeting as well. That would be the good place to demo it.
Yeah, it's not that hard. We can do that. We can come up here and just show how we open up the GIS portal, how you get to it. But yeah, we'll make that the point of one of our next meetings. Anyway, that's the committee reports that I've got.
Anything else with Tier 2? Okay. Eric, anything for training?
I haven't heard anything specific on that white spray wipe course. Have you heard anything about that from State Fire? That white spray wipe they're going to do in Davis County?
We will be bringing in courses as requested. We're kind of looking at the attendance at each one and what the feedback is. But it looks like we're probably going to move more towards that method of training a lot of people, because some of the other processes take a lot of resource.
What is that related to?
On decon method, as far as supposed to conserve time and save water and resources. They figured that level A suit's going to be trashed anyway, so instead of taking the time to put everybody in that whole pool and do all that decon and end up with all that waste, they're just kind of concentrating on where the zipper is and being careful when you decon and hugging a suit, because they're going to do that anyway, instead of filling that pool full of water, more or less. Does that sound right?
Yes. The combined waste rule says anything that you add to a hazardous material makes all the material hazardous. So if you use an excessive amount of water and trying to decon things that you're going to throw away anyway, now you've made a lot of material hazardous that didn't need to be there. So basically it's you peel out of the suit, you step out, and everything gets wrapped up and removed. They only wipe the areas that they're going to actually need to get the person out of a suit. We used to scrub the bottom of the boots and everything else that people would, and that's a lot of time, effort, water.
To leave them in the hot zone and then throw away.
The people, yes. Save the suits. They're worth the suits are $1,000 a piece.
We're free.
Yeah.
We're volunteers. We're free. I encourage everyone to look at that firstrespondertraining.gov website. There are probably over 100 different classes played along there, and they range from awareness to managing the incidents and going through hands-on on a lot of different things, whether it's chemical or biological or medical. If you want to take a course on a specialist on the oil rigs going down the road, or even the ones on the rail, they have training that ranges from a couple days to 2 weeks, and all you do is learn about the train cars or whatever you want while you're specialization is, but they're paid for, they fly out there, they feed you, they're pretty well worth taking. And I chatted with Dr. Check, it's about doing a presentation on carbon monoxide and hydrogen cyanide, what we're starting to call the toxic twins in fire. Our normal meters that you put on your finger that say what your blood oxygen content is don't really work with carbon monoxide. I have no idea what they do on hydrogen cyanide, but
They don't detect.
You still have the same amount of oxygen in your system, you just can't transfer it to the cell.
Right, but the meter doesn't know that, so the meter tells, hey, your blood is saturated. Well, it's because it can't get out of the blood. So we have special meters. These are gases that will essentially kill you. You can't see them, you can't smell them. So I've chatted with Dr. Check, it's about doing a presentation on that, I guess, June or July, since.
Yeah, somebody has some of the, okay. Yeah, either would work. You guys want to plan next month?
Sure.
Okay.
The RAD 57 to do the carbon monoxide, will they, can you get those to do the hydrogen cyanide also?
In our blood?
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea.
Yeah, the RAD 57 will give you a CO2 carbon monoxide level.
No, they won't. They won't give you cyanide.
Okay, I didn't know if there was a chance for them to pick that up too.
Yep, I'm here, so.
It has to search for, I don't know what's going to happen.
They're getting quite common EMS use anymore than 57.
But HCN is more in the cell instead of getting it off blood, is that right?
Correct.
I guess some of those questions answered, I hope. But from what we can look for on scene, we got a lot of synthetics now on fire. You know, we didn't have this years ago. Houses burn a lot faster with all those synthetics. That cyanide is one of the more common things to watch out for. You know, we don't smell anything. We'll pack up anyway. Got all this foam over there, smolder, and it could be a bad thing. Other than that, nothing in one train.
Okay. We'll go ahead and do the roundtable before we turn our time over to Alina for opioid crisis presentation. I don't have anything else.
Just other than what we talked about with this 5150, I hope everything goes off well. We do have some issues and problems. I appreciate you guys' insight. And whatever comes our way, we're grateful for your willingness to be here and support us in this. So hopefully we can pull off that edge.
Well, it looks like they're well underway on our natural gas transmission line headed down Highway 89 right now. It's started construction. It's a 24-inch transmission line that's running through there, replacing the smaller one. It's due to run to first part of 2020. I don't know because it runs right through my yard. but that's the construction going on there on 89 right now. That's replacing that. I think it was a 12-inch line that was running through there before. So they're doubling the size of it. So that's one thing we're going to have to be aware of. I don't know when they'll start filling and testing and stuff like that, but pretty big project going on. Those are the ones that make the news across the nation when they get hit.
I think the first day they had a really bad wreck there where the car went up on.
I've got a couple of things I'd like to just pass around. There's two different things, so I'll just pass them each way. And while those are going around, I'll give you a little bit of background. The health department obviously has a wide variety of different projects and services that we provide. We received some funding a while back to address the opioid crisis. That's going on across the nation, across the state, across our county, and little Brigham City. So it's here, unfortunately. And as far as our rates across the state, Brigham City actually rates about 7th across the state for opioid deaths. So we definitely have an issue here. And I know you guys have all been talking about emergency response in an entirely different way. It's fun to see familiar faces and to get a little better understanding and background of some of the things that you're doing, and God bless you for this. Like, oh wow, that's going to be pretty exciting and a nightmare all at the same time, right? But I would like to say with this particular topic, really I was hoping to just kind of pick your brain a little bit, expose you to some materials and to some resources that we have available at the health department. As I've mentioned, we've had a couple of different opportunities for some funding to come through. Most of it has been more short term. So when the president at the nation's capital says we're going to get some money out for opioid stuff, it's like, okay, well, to get like a year's worth of funding to do a little bit of stuff. And obviously this is something that we're going to have to work on for some time. The health department does a variety of substance abuse prevention programs. We do substance abuse treatment, as most of you probably are aware. But really I wanted to also expose you to the fact that at the state level, they have put together an opioid crisis response team. So like you guys are doing crisis response in a different kind of avenue, they're doing that at a state level and encouraging us to bring it down to a local level. So knowing you do what you do, that's why I wanted to just kind of pick your brain a little bit. If we should happen to have some type of catastrophic thing happen with opioid overdose situation in our area, we would be asked to respond, obviously. And I've met with law enforcement, I've met with EMS to some capacity, and want to further those conversations. But honestly, most of what I hear is whoever arrives on scene first, it's their baby. And that makes sense. We just want to make sure that we are also known as a resource to help with some of that as far as some of the education to get that out to the community. And I see businesses here, Newport here, Auto Lead, West Liberty, for working to provide education to employers and employees at the worksite level as well. We know that two-thirds of the people that have opioid issues are getting their opioids from friends and family. So it's very vital that we're just doing general education as far as safe storage, safe use, safe disposal, those kinds of things. So we have a variety of resources that we've put together as far as educational materials, and I only brought a couple of those, the most pertinent two, but we have some others, and I'm in the process of having them all kind of reviewed and also a few little adjustments made. Like, for example, I absolutely despise this picture. Working in the field of prevention and in the field of treatment, this can be a trigger for certain people. So we're going to try to get rid of that. We're going to add our crisis lines, make sure some of the stuff that I want to share with you. We're going to tighten those up just a little bit and then work to get those out. So again, at work sites, if we can get those out, if we can talk to work sites about having policies, so when someone goes out for surgery and they're coming back, that there's a policy in place to say, yeah, we've got some heavy duty equipment that we're working on here, and we want to make sure people are as clear-minded as possible. So when they come back from a surgery, we're going to make sure that the opioids have left the system, and if they need any help, or if it's an ongoing pain management kind of thing, that we have some protections in place for other employees and for our businesses and that kind of thing. So I kind of wanted to just throw out my contact information if any of you are interested in any of that information. And then really honestly, I wanted to share some resources. So we have a crisis line with the health department, and I know there's all kinds of crisis lines across the community, and that's great, they're valuable and we need them. But the health department's crisis line is a little bit different. If someone is in some type of situation where they need assistance, either medical assistance or you know, they're having a mental health issue, they're having an overdose or a substance abuse issue, oftentimes what we keep hearing is from family members and even from other agencies, is our only recourse is to get them in a vehicle and take them to the hospital or take them to the jail. And that happens sometimes, and those are viable options sometimes. But oftentimes there's some work that could be done at a crisis moment that with a crisis counselor that could help mitigate some of that. So the hospital's not always the best place to go, and neither is the sheriff's office or the jail, right? So law enforcement has a lot to tackle, EMS has a lot to tackle with this issue as well. So we just want to make sure that people know that we do have a crisis line. People can call, they can talk to a counselor, they're aware of the services that are available in the community, so they can tap them into a resource. So some of that information is in this trifold brochure. Another thing that's really important to point out is we've been having some really high success with our medication-assisted therapy, which is an opportunity where counseling and medication is combined. So someone has to be free from an opioid for a certain amount of time, and they work through with a physician to make sure they're eligible, to make sure they're their health status is appropriate for that. But they receive a medication, they receive actually an injection once a month, and that's coupled with therapy, so that assists them to get through if they have an opioid addiction. So we're seeing a lot of success with that, more so than just the average treatment options that most see. So we want to make sure people are aware of that, the crisis line. And then also another important piece to mention is the availability of naloxone or Narcan. Most of you probably have heard of that and are familiar with that. That's also another medication. It can be either delivered with an injection or with a nasal spray. And that is for someone that's in an opioid overdose situation. That can be administered to pull them out of that overdose situation. Oftentimes there's multiple doses that have to be administered, so we have those kits available at the health department, and we would be happy to share those with you, or to share them with a family member, to share them with the business if they would like to have a couple of those on hand for employees. But that is something that we would like to also bring to your attention as well. Any questions or comments? Yes.
So I'm a physician, so how can we refer people into you?
Okay, great. So we have a physician that's out of our Logan office, actually.
Okay.
And he would meet with a person. You can just call it the health department. And he would meet with the person, make sure that they're eligible. They do some blood work ahead of time to make sure that that's okay deal for them. And again, they do have to be free from the substance for a period of time, which you're probably aware of. So we're trying to work with like the jail, as they come out of jail, that they could, if they're interested, that they could join into that program. And then it's set up so that they receive the therapy as well, in addition to that.
How about just general, basic, like mental health counseling?
So that's another really good question. So the way it's set up in our area is the Bear River Health Department is situated as a substance abuse, we're called the Substance Abuse Authority in our community. So any substance abuse related things, I mean, we have lots of wonderful, great private counselors and counseling agencies that are available in our community, and they're all great. Ours is just set up as the Substance Abuse Authority, so if it's specifically to do with substance abuse, then people can come to us. We accept insurance, Medicare, private insurance, and then we work with people with no insurance on a sliding fee scale. We also offer mental health treatment as well. So it doesn't have to just be substance abuse related.
Okay.
However, Bear River Mental Health, which we never get confused. Bear River Mental Health is the mental health authority in our community, but they are basically set up to serve people with Medicaid. So if somebody comes to us and they have Medicaid, we're going to shift them that direction. If somebody comes to them with mental health or substance abuse issues and they have insurance or whatever, they can shift them to a private provider or they can shift them to us as well.
Okay. Yeah, so, a lot of my issue is people without insurance.
So, yeah.
Severely need counseling, exactly. Something, and they're on that slope that they're going to end up in the jails with opiate issues.
So, yeah, so we work with them on a sliding fee scale, and please don't quote me, but normally to see a healthcare provider, it's a mental health care provider, it's like $100 an hour. And we're 30 or less.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like sliding fee scale. So okay. I shouldn't put a price out there, but it...
Significantly less.
Yes.
Well, I was at a conference back in D.C. in March, and they were talking about this, this problem. And one of the things that they brought up, and I think this is just nationwide, but they were saying that typically it's the treatment we're like normally 60 to 90 day kind of process to try and get people detoxed or whatever. But they were finding that isn't sufficient enough for a lot of people to end up relapsing too easily. Do you find, is that the case here in our area? Are we dealing with that same issue? Is there a need for a facility where somebody could get treatment for a longer period? That kind of thing. We as a county, the commissioners, we talked about, do we need something like that here in this area?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes, and that comes up all the time. Yes, as far as like a detox or an inpatient treatment, Fox Elder County really has nothing at this point.
And one of the things that, and it was thrown around, of course, this is just speculation, so I'm not trying to tell anybody, don't run out and tell, hey, they're going to buy this building now. We thought about the old hospital, the care facility moved out from the Tremont. As a potential place to maybe have something like that, or if there is a need, but we just need to look at it, but it's a.
It's definitely a need.
It seemed like a real problem.
Yeah, and when we had that email conversation not too long ago about that, yeah, it's definitely a need. Like, I talked with the counselors, I went to our deputy director for substance abuse department, and yeah, I mean, there are some options for detox in cash, and there definitely are in, you know, down Weber Way, and some inpatient Weber and Salt Lake Way, but we're so limited in our area for that. And, you know, relapse, I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, relapse, people think, well, I have a family member, which probably, if we're honest, most of us do, somewhere in the chain that we have. It's fairly common, in other words, unfortunately. But we have, in order to access those services, it's really, really challenging. But oftentimes people think, well, I have a family member, and they had knee surgery, and now it led to this, and now it's this big, huge thing, which is so sad and so unfortunate, or an on-the-job injury, and, you know, they had to go out and have surgery or whatever, and then exposure to those opioids. And there are other alternative methods that we can turn to instead of opioids, or in addition with short-term opioid use. That's really, really important. That's part of our education process. But oftentimes people think, well, they just got to, like, pull themselves up, and they got to get through it, and then they're better. And addiction's different than that. And to have 6-8 relapses is actually pretty common. It's part of a process. It's usually not a one-and-done deal. It's very difficult to overcome.
Well, one of their things that I mentioned, too, is that as far as, you know, because a lot of you guys know employees and stuff that possibly, you know, your businesses are dealing with this, and you don't want to lose those employees. But somehow we've got to bridge that gap, I think, because obviously it's a big problem nationwide where people are getting the treatment, but then they relapse too easily. We've got to somehow take them a little bit further to get them to the point where, you know, they can stay viable in their jobs and, you know, keep their life in order.
Exactly, and that ongoing support is really critical. Yeah, I agree 100%.
Well, I saw a special, I can't remember, on television, but there's like, I want to say it's a prison system back, I want to say like Rhode Island or something. It's where a woman is actually the, you know, the warden, and then she hooked up with one of the local physicians and then one of the local, like three ladies that are running the system. But they take prisoners that are, and the prisoners have to qualify for this program in-house. And so they start like 6-7 months before they release them. They start working with them with mental health issues and getting them on medications that get them off the opioids and everything. And once they're parole, they actually keep track of them in the, you know, in public after their parole. And the guys have to come back, you know, they get jobs. They keep monitoring the prescriptions that they're giving them or the medications that they're giving them. And they're saying that, and these guys are doing really, really well. They said their return rate or staying out of prison is like at 95%. And, you know, they only have like 5% of the guys that are on this opioid issue when they're in prison and everything. And, you know, they're becoming viable members of the community, but they keep track of them, you know, and they say it's a system that's working really, really
yeah.
well.
I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that the sheriff's office is actually working on, as people are released from jail, it's just kind of new and getting going, but they're looking at a mentor type of program. And they're looking for people as people are inmates are released, that they have that support and there's some accountability and there's that. I mean, support's the best way I can look at saying it, but like some frame of reference, some structure for them. Has having them work with someone that can continue to say, okay, you're struggling in this way, let's try to get you into this. Like, you're having a difficult time finding a job, let's get you in here. So a lot of times when people are released from jail, especially if they have like felony charges or they have drug charges, they have a difficult time finding work. They have a difficult, very, very difficult time finding housing. We hear that over and over again. Nobody wants them to live in their neighborhood. And that's one of the things we're working on too, like, is decreasing stigma. Like, I hate this picture. But decreasing stigma, like people that use pills, you know, like, and this one has the syringe and things like that, there becomes this stigma that they're those people. And they're all of us with all of, you know, all of within all of our families. And we need to work to provide them support and aftercare and that mentoring. So they are working on that. We're hoping that we can, some of this funding that we have, provide a little bit more support for them as well, so maybe some training opportunities and things like that. So yeah, it's quite a big issue that we all kind of need to work together on. So from your perspective, as far as like emergency response, I'm going to have more materials made so that I can get those out to work sites, to EMS, to law enforcement. So we'll have those readily available. So if someone has a family member, if someone has a crisis situation, they know that there's a line that they can call. They can talk to somebody to get them through that crisis situation. They can determine if they do need to go to the emergency room. They can determine if Narcan or Naloxone is something that's needed. But if it's something that we should have in our homes, just as a precaution. So, you know, and then also just sharing that message about cleaning our cabinets out, storing them properly, getting rid of them. We have drop boxes at the Brigham Police Department, at the Tremont Police Department, and at the Brigham Community Pharmacy currently in our county. So just trying to get that information out so that we can work together to decrease this issue.
Well, one of my things was, you know, like referral surgeons in some positions, when I have said no to prescriptions to mostly opioids, they kind of look at me like I'm crazy. Mm-hmm. But no, I got my Diet Coke and my aspirin, I'll be happy. Just give me, you know, I don't need to.
I wanted to ask about that. Is there any pushback from law enforcement and health departments back to physicians about that? Because I still see exactly that. Like, my patients end up in the ER, they're going to walk out with this group of narcotics.
And
if
you say no, you almost feel like
there's something wrong with you if you're saying no to a prescription. And we still have, I hate to say it, the pain management clinics around when I see 120 milligrams of OxyContin prescribed for a patient each day.
Yeah, that is one arm of this educational piece, is the prescribers as well. And then taking it a different way, this is going to tax my brain, I hate to admit this, but taking it a different way is educating us as consumers. When we go to the doctor, they're providing a service and a business. They're a business. It's a calling as well, but they're providing a service for us. And as consumers, we need to be educated. We need to ask questions. We need to be our own advocate, and we need to be educated as far as what we expect to come from that. And if we have a little bit more awareness about this issue, we don't want to scare everybody to death. Opioids have a place. They have a purpose. But just for example, when you were talking about oral surgeons, you know, my kids are older now, but like when my kids were in, my son was a freshman in college, just barely moved away from home. He came home to have his wisdom teeth out. And he received a bottle of 30, Percocet. I always get Percocet and Percodan mixed up for some reason. Anyway, so he received that prescription, and I said to him, until you are not taking any more pain medicine, you're not going back to school. Last thing I'm going to do is send my child back to a college dorm with Percocet. Not happening. I think he took
it from school.
I know, it could have.
Waste of semester.
Yeah. No, that was dumb, wasn't it? Save me money. Lose my son, but save me money. Anyways, I think he took one. So the fact that it was prescribed that much, and I was a little miffed. I mean, I work in the health field, so I kind of have a little bit more of an idea about it. So when I went back to the doctor for the checkup, and it's like, what the hell were you thinking? Why did you give my college kid, you know, this, you know, I didn't say it quite like that, but, you know, we have to be accountable. We have to kind of think about, like, we always talk about ask the doctor 5 questions, and I'm not going to remember what they are, but one of them is this necessary? Are there other options? How long am I going to be on it? Are you going to taper me off? You know, those kinds of conversations where we're a little bit more in control. So the prescribers do need to be held accountable, just like Dr. Checkins is talking about. Like, there's a lot of time when it's overly prescribed, but our doctors are doing better, honestly. They are doing better than they were. So that is positive. And there's some checks and balances with doctor shopping and with some, as you're probably aware of, the DAPL and things like that, where they have to log in what the patient's receiving. And so there's a little bit of some check and balance with that. But yeah, providing education to our prescribers, providing education at our pharmacies. I would like to see a physician, when they write out a prescription for an opioid, to write a prescription for naloxone along with it. You might not have to get it filled, or you might, either one of them really, or you might, and nowadays you can even get naloxone without a prescription. But just to send the message, this could have some risks, you know, this does have some risks that go along with it. So that conversation is held with either with the pharmacist or with the doctor and the patient. So we have a long ways to go, but if you have thoughts or if you have suggestions, I also brought some cards, so I would love for some feedback or your thoughts. And if we should happen to have a situation, so for example, like happened in Park City with the two young people that died, you guys are aware of this, where they received it through the mail. So like CNN kind of descended on Park City, and they really bashed the school district. It was really interesting how all that came about. It was like, what's the school doing? Why are these young teenagers dying? And it's like, they didn't have it at school. They didn't bring it. I mean, it had nothing to do with school, really, but there really wasn't a plan in place of how do we handle this kind of a situation. So when you talk about PIOs and you talk about emergency response and having your right people in the right places, it's important that we all kind of have these conversations so we know where resources are available. If something should happen, we can say, maybe we need to call in some of those counselors from the health department that can come in and talk to us about addiction or talk to us about MAT or something like that.
I was going to say, another thing, workers' comp people, is back in the day, I had an issue with an employee that I, you know, suspected issues, but it was back when they were doing the prescriptions for a year. And she was on opioids, painkillers, for a previous non-disclosed work injury that she had before she hired. Every year, at about the time that her prescription was up, she claimed she had a workers' comp injury, so she could get her prescription.
So she needed a whole other kind of support.
But I'm saying that you might want to look at bringing these guys in, because if there's a pattern, that they keep reporting an injury because they're wanting to get their prescriptions renewed.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like clockwork. And I kept trying to tell all workers' comp covers at that time, like, she's got an issue. And I said, because she filed a claim this year, on this date last year, she's doing it this year, she did it the year before, and
go for 10-year scripting.
Yeah, they just kind of blew me off, and it's like, she's got an issue.
Well, and again, that just brings about the point and just helps reinforce it, that it really does take all of us working together. It takes employers understanding in their HR department, okay, we've got some things we need to work through, and I know there's some limitations there as well, but let's have some policies in place. Let's have conversations with our families. Let's try to reduce that stigma so that people can get in and get the resources and then the help that they need, so it's not 4 years, 10 years down the line that they're still struggling with that. Let's open up and know that we do have crisis lines available, so that if something happens at a particular time, we know how to respond, we know who we can get help, you know, from, those kinds of things. So it really is a multifaceted kind of approach.
I have a question. What level of coordination do you have with your crisis number with 911 dispatchers, and what kind of education do 911 dispatchers get?
Actually, none right now. That's a really good point.
I need to introduce you to Nikki.
Yes, right. I know you quite well. I should.
Because a lot of people know 911, and they're going to hit those three numbers before they're going to try to look up your crisis line.
You're right. And I don't know, like, as far as when you.